The Murthy Law Firm has been clarifying U.S. immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome. I am Sheila Murthy, President and CEO of the Murthy Law Firm. Thank you so much for joining us for today's discussion on the L1A and L1B. Joining me for today's discussion are two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, Joel Yanovich and Kevin Andrews, who work in the L1A, L1B space and have many, many, many years of successfully working with very complex cases, regular cases, different kinds of situations. So I would for sure reach out to them if you have any questions. So what is the L1? The L1 basically allows a multinational company to transfer its executives, managers, and specialized knowledge workers from a foreign office to the U.S. operations. What is the minimum requirement? There's a minimum 1 year continuous year of employment abroad within the past 3 years. Again, there are some nuances to each of this, and it matters in some ways, and hopefully we'll be able to touch base on a lot of the issues. And, of course, for the L1A, you need to work in an executive or managerial capacity, and for the specialized knowledge workers, the L1B capacity, right? So what is a qualifying company? Basically, a company must have a qualifying relationship like a parent, a subsidiary, an affiliate, or branch office, sometimes joint ventures can work, etc. So there's, of course, a couple of common misconceptions. Some people think, oh, you know what, the foreign company and the U.S. company have the exact same name or very similar. That does not result in automatic qualification. You still have to go through all of the legal criteria required. And in terms of the ownership structure, right, either the majority ownership is by one entity or the common ownership must be by the same individuals. And I think as we were discussing when we were preparing for today's call, we were saying, or podcast rather, that it has to be the same individuals because people assume related individuals will be sufficient. Sorry, that's not how it works. Also, the proportional ownership where it's, say, three of us, you know, Kevin, Joel, and myself own the company, then it must be in the same proportional ownership by the same group, et cetera, so that you comply and fit within the parameters of the qualifying relationship. An interesting point, of course, is that sole proprietorships cannot file an L1 petition. It must be a separate legal entity. And with that, I'm going to invite you, Joel, to talk a little bit about the L1A and the L1B.
Hi, Sheila. Thank you. Yes, so we file a lot of L1 cases, and so just kind of understanding some of the basics is important. So with managers, L1A managers, so as Sheila mentioned, you have L1A managers. You also have L1A executives. And so for managers, a manager would primarily be someone who manages an organization or division or an essential function within the company. So we do file a lot of functional manager cases where we talk about essential functions as opposed to the more traditional manager, which we also file a good number of, where they're managing, it's more about managing people and kind of day-to-day activities like that. In addition, other activities done by a manager, they supervise other managers or professionals. Or if they don't have any direct supervision, they can just function at a senior level within the hierarchy or as to the function that's being managed. Have someone who has discretion over operations, that would be considered someone who's managerial, and they should be spending a majority of their time, more than half their time, performing managerial duties. So with executives, we are typically looking at people who are directing the management of the organization or a major component thereof, someone who sets policies and goals, and someone who operates with minimal supervision. With a lot of companies in today's day and age, it's sometimes hard to distinguish who's a manager and who's an executive. Ultimately, though, with USCIS, L1, you're either one or the other. If you want to say the person is both, you have to show how they qualify as both. So typically, you try to avoid that. But there are situations where you may have to do that. And then moving on to L1B for specialized knowledge, these are employees who have special knowledge of the company or the products, the services, the markets that the company is working within. They may possess advanced knowledge of company processes. Typically, this is knowledge that's gained only through working for that particular company. That's usually what you're going to see with L1B. And you need someone who's a key employee, not just the fact that they're important. You may have a lot of important employees, but USCIS kind of distinguishes that someone a little bit more elevated than that. And so what we will see, a common challenge we will encounter are consulting firms that try to use L1B. There are situations where a consulting firm can absolutely use L1B, but if it's just your kind of routine, you know, tech gun for hire services for another company, most of the time that's not going to involve specialized knowledge because it's not knowledge from your employer. It's going to be some kind of IT knowledge you got that other people in your field typically would have as well. So there are also some special rules for new offices. I think maybe, Kevin, you want to talk about that?
Joel, before we jump into new office, I have a quick question. So when you said they need to spend more than 50% of the time on managerial duties for the L1A part of it, a lot of the IT consulting companies, maybe that's interconnected with what you just said, a lot of the engineering managers or IT managers tend not to do more than 50% in managing. I think they do quite a bit in actual work, and maybe they just supervise a whole bunch of engineers or other senior level people. Is that a potential problem?
Yeah, I mean, if they're going to be spending most of the time doing the work as opposed to managing, then in theory, that's not going to qualify. They wouldn't be viewed as a manager under immigration law. A lot of the IT managers that I see, they, you know, from what we're told, they're spending a good chunk of their time managing or overseeing the work, reviewing work being performed by the lower level tech people. So your tech knowledge very well may be absolutely essential to the work you're doing, because you can't review somebody else's work unless you understand it. But if you're spending most of your time just being the you know, actual worker bee, doing the actual coding, et cetera, that's going to be tough to argue that the person qualifies for L1A as a manager.
Thank you so much for the clarification. I'm sure it'll help many people who are like thinking, oh my God, now what do I do? You know, or how do I restructure it, or how do I make the position work? So then jumping back, I guess, Kevin, for the new office petitions, what are the requirements? What are the challenges? What do we see?
Yeah, thanks, Sheila and Joel. So a new office petition allows for a little bit of flexibility. You know, like typically for an L1A and L1B, it's for an organization that's already established. It's for, you know, hit the ground running, performing the managerial duties or the specialized knowledge position. But for L1A, there is this new office option. So typically you get a three-year approval, but with new office for a regular L1 filing. For a new office petition, it's for an initial one-year approval, but the good thing about that is that you can start by doing non-managerial tasks as part of that transition period. So in that year, you would the managerial candidate would have to hire professional workers to build the staff so that at the end of the year filing the extension, you can show, like, look, I am now working in a managerial capacity. I'm not performing non-managerial functions. So the essential ingredients for filing an initial for a new office petition would be a very detailed business plan, a 3-5 year plan. I think is helpful to show goals of the company. It shouldn't be too should definitely be grounded in reality. You know, I'm gonna hire 20,000 people and revolutionize, you know, X. I think that might be a little ambitious. And then the company does need to show that there's a financial ability to operate. There's no hard number for that, but just they're going to look at it in the context of the business. This doesn't have to necessarily be revenue. It could be investment fund. It could just be capital. There needs to be a clear organizational structure, and this is really consistent for all the petitions, but I think it's really important for at the outset of a new, you know, company. In a lot of ways, it's a good practice to show, you know, regimentation of an army, even if it's for, you know, a small group just in the beginning. Again, if you get over that hurdle, that's just for 1 year. You know, a lot of this is kind of like a business loan, you know, and at the end of the year, it's like, show me what you've done. So the extension needs to show, like, look, there's business and it's grown to support this fully managerial or executive role. That there are, you know, so no more non-qualifying duties, and that you have to look at actual hires, not prospective, at least at the time of filing the extension. Two more things I wanted to mention. One is that, you know, in our post-COVID digital world, working in a virtual office kind of environment is doable and practical, but it's not going to work for a new office L1 filing, so something to keep in mind. And very related to that is that USCIS through Fraud Detection National Security, FDNS, have really stepped up site visits in the H1 context of too, but also in the L1 context. And you know, they'll come visit wherever you are. If you're working from home, if that's one of the physical offices that you have, they may come and, you know, hover over your shoulder and ask what you're doing. So new office is a great option, but not without complexity.
Great, thank you, Kevin. So I know that there's been a bunch of changes that have occurred in 2025 earlier this year. Some kind of a settlement, new interview requirements, a whole bunch of couple, you know, things that would really be helpful, whether it's the employer or the employee, primarily employers listening to this. So, Joel, if I could invite you to jump in and share some updates.
Yes. So one of the big changes, kind of unfortunately, was a couple of years back, there was a settlement related to delays in processing and some other issues. And USCIS agreed to bundle, or basically, if you had an L2 extension, or I guess an L2 change of status that was filed with the principal L1's case, and it was filed with premium, they would, as a courtesy, adjudicate the L2 at the same time. Or I don't know, that I would refer to as a courtesy. They used to do it as a courtesy routinely. The lawsuit kind of, based on the settlement, they were required to do it. That ended in January of 2025, January 18th, 2025. So they were no longer required to do it. Initially, though, we saw that they were still, it looked like they were routinely still adjudicating these cases together. And unfortunately, as time has gone on, that seems to be happening less and less. So for L2 spouses, for the L2 extensions which also gives them the work authorization, you're basically stuck waiting, or we will have people that will, after the L1 is approved, the L2 may leave and get a visa stamp and then come back in with a new I-94 that way. But unfortunately, the USCIS is no longer necessarily adjudicating those cases together. The other thing, that the very recent change that's going to go into effect at the beginning of September of this year, is that interviews are going to be required for almost all visa stamping, or as commonly referred to, visa applications at the consular post. So the in-person interviews normally are very, especially for spouses, but even for the L1s, a lot of times they're very, you know, you're in and out within a few minutes. They don't ask a lot of questions. That's not always the case. But the fact you have to get an interview is going to very, very likely result in extensive delays at consular posts, especially busy consular posts like the ones in India. So I would say, if you're going to be traveling, you need to plan way ahead of time. Make sure you have your appointments booked. And frankly, some people are just going to avoid traveling altogether. The interview waiver has been basically gone. The age restriction has been gone. So it's a big problem.
sounds really quite daunting and overwhelming. So just to clarify for people, they can file the L2 extension with the L1 extension. The USCIS is spending more time, effort, energy, and money to separate the two rather than just wrapping it up for the family at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, whether they're being separated or not, and again, sometimes they will be adjudicated together. So if you're filing premium anyhow, I would say go ahead and include them together in the same envelope, but you can't count on them actually adjudicating them at the same time.
Got it. Great. Thank you for that update. So this whole work authorization thing, this, Kevin, is a little bit different, or quite different, I should say, than almost any other applicant that gets the EAD, whether it's the H-1 or the H-4 EAD or other EAD-dependent categories. And how does the L2 work authorization sort of work? What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, L2 work authorization definitely is fundamentally different in the process of like H4. And up until, you know, relatively recently, not very recent, but an L2 spouse would have to apply for an EAD, a separate application. So, you know, practically that meant if you're entering on L2, you do have to apply for the EAD once you enter and then wait, you know, maybe 4, 6 or longer months. Actually, if you file an EAD standalone right now, it takes like over a year compared to filing them together, L2 and H EAD or H4 and EAD. But now the L2S designation, L2 spouse, doesn't apply to children, can work as soon as it's incident to status, is what they say. So like the fact the work authorization is just by virtue of having the L2 status. So you can, you know, enter and start working immediately. There's no EAD required. The L2S I-94 card is sufficient for I-9 purpose. That and the identity document are sufficient for I-9 purposes. So the L2 flexibility and work authorization, not just what you're doing, but how to get it, is one little silver lining in a lot of this stuff.
So what about when you said the I-94 with the L2S is acceptable for I-9 purposes, so employers can take that into consideration? What about driver's license? Because that's going to be the next question by somebody listening.
Right, yeah. So typically with I-9, you have to prove identity and work authorization. And you might be able to prove that with one document, like a U.S. citizen with their passport that has both. But like, for example, a foreign national that has a social security number, they couldn't use that because it'll say, you know, DHS work authorization required. And so the I-94 card and the L2S approval notice, there's no ID there. So, the I-9 does give other options. I think state ID, passport would, you know, certainly passport would be the most obvious to do if you don't have the state ID yet. So those two things combined is enough to prove to the employer you can start working that day.
Okay, so we don't really have updates from whether the driver's license the Department of Motor Vehicles will give us, because I know a lot of times I do consultations where they're like, okay, I can stay here and I have a 240-day work authorization automatically by filing the H-1B or L-1 extension, but I'm not going, how am I going to get the driver's license to drop the kids off to school? I can't go to school.
It can depend on the state, so they need to check on the state law, and it will also potentially depend on the DMV officer, because I've seen people in states where I didn't think they were going to get the driver's license, were able to renew them. Also, some states do offer another class of driver's license where you don't have to provide any immigration status documents. So depending on where you live, a lot of them do offer this other class of driver's license where frankly, this was really designed for undocumented immigrants because they wanted them to be able to drive and have car insurance in case they get an accident. But if you have one of those driver's licenses, it's a driver's license. You won't be able to necessarily use it in another state, but in the state you're in, it should work like any other driver's license.
Great. Yeah, thank you very much for that clarification, Joel. So, Kevin, what about, I know we want to try to wrap up. We always try to do these now that we are doing these podcasts a little bit more streamlined, efficient, but still interesting, exciting, and sharing a wealth of knowledge. Do you have any closing takeaways for what an employer should be doing to try to get the L1A or L1B approved?
For L's, generally speaking, the corporate qualifying relationship has to be thoroughly documented, and that can take the form of many different kinds of documents, bylaws, shareholder agreement, SEC 10-K filing for big companies. So that needs to be clear. You know, when it's a parent-subsidiary relationship, when it's one person with common majority ownership between two entities, it's pretty clear. Sometimes it gets muddy, so you gotta have to, you know, whiteboard it and flowchart it and figure it out sometimes. As I mentioned before, the business plan is probably the main pillar in a lot of ways of the new office petition. So, you know, don't slack on that part. Don't just rely on a ChatGPT or something for that. That should really be fleshed out and be realistic but not to the point, you know, where it's like, yeah, I'm going to hire one person at the end. Like, it has to be realistic in terms of, the market performance, but then also eligible for the extension. So there's a Goldilocks, place there. The when filing for dependents, you know, I typically it's a good practice to file them as early as possible, and every time you file for an extension of the principal applicant, you know, L1A, L1B, even if for whatever reason there's still a lot of time left on the petition, this typically happens with like promotions or something, go ahead and file for the dependents, family, all family, because you don't want to have two different expiration dates. You know, if you're lucky, you don't think about immigration every single day. You think about it, you know, every few years or so, and you don't want to have one date in your head and realize, oh, wait, we had to file 6 months earlier, and now there's this expensive problem. So I think it's just a good idea to file them together anytime you're filing. And then, you know, last thing, I think we sort of glossed over it, but there is a premium processing option for L1s. You know, L1 filings look like, if anybody remembers what yellow pages are and telephone books are, in the evidence and things, sometimes compared to an H1, that can be, you know, more of a pamphlet. So, I think USCIS digests them accordingly. So, if there's a time-sensitive issue, if there's a person overseas needing to come over now, those might be good use cases for premium processing. Maybe filing an initial, L1 new office to get here sooner, you know, might be something where that would be critical, but maybe not an extension, you know, unless it's one of those states with the driver's license issue that we were talking about.
Wonderful. Okay, great. And so those were the do's. Just to wrap it up with what we've sort of already gone over briefly, the do's and don'ts we talked about, and the don'ts are: do not assume that a similar name for the foreign entity and the U.S. entity automatically will result in a qualifying relationship. As we said earlier, it does not. You absolutely don't want to confuse important job duties with specialized knowledge job duties, and that was already explained. So you want to show that this is specialized knowledge that can be only obtained because of having worked abroad, as opposed to, and it should be important and not just like mundane day-to-day tasks. And, you know, you don't want to be relying on old policies, old regulations, which normally is usually, you know, decades old, but in this current climate, we're talking about even something, anything more than 6 months. There's been changes, as you know, in processing and policies, and the current administration is looking at, you know, issuing approvals or RFEs. And as we talked earlier, we should expect more RFEs. Prior administration, we've had approval ratings of over 90%, which we very well may expect that number could go down sometime in later in 2025. And so, you know, what we always tell people is, in spite of all the procedural complexities, we at Mooty Law Firm, and Joel Yanovich is, you know, supervising the team. Kevin's an integral part of that team. We have a wonderful team of attorneys, paralegals, and staff. It absolutely is an invaluable option, very valuable, very useful for as your company may continue to grow and have foreign entities or foreign branch offices. And hopefully with working with a great team like at the Murthy Law Firm, you will be able to very much greatly improve and increase your chances of the approval. So we hope that today's discussion has given you a flavor of what's there. As I said, we certainly are happy, willing, and able, ready, willing, and able to serve you and help you in this process. And on behalf of myself, Sheila Murthy, on behalf of Kevin Andrews, on behalf of Joel Yonovich, and the entire Murthy Law Firm team, we're delighted and honored that you were part of this conversation today, and we look forward to continuing to guide you and take very good care of you. Hope you have a wonderful rest of the summer. Take care and good afternoon.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.